Panel members and officials from the department, most welcome to this meeting. As you remember, we were never presented with the white paper on foreign affairs by the department. So we thought that it is important that we have an opportunity for a presentation like that and allow members to engage with your concern. But most importantly, I must apologize both to the members and to yourselves for a late start. Next door, we're having a meeting with some people from Scotland. They're having a meeting with us. So the meeting just ate some 15 or so minutes into this meeting. I want to apologize for that. We only invite people and that take the for granted, both the honorable members as well as the officials. So with that, the meeting is declared open and you're most welcome. Are there any apologies, Luvarano?
Thank you, Chair. I have two apologies from Honorable Mansami and Honorable Jack.
Thank you, Chair. Honorable?
Honorable Mansami and Honorable Jack.
Okay, next time we're talking about initial blah, eh? Because you will have two Mansami, so I'm say HH, FP, or JG. Honorable Halapa?
Thank you very much, Chair. I think you've dealt with the matter quite very diplomatically when you started by apologizing, so I think you qualify as a diplomat. But yeah, I think it was pretty much unacceptable that the meeting has started quite a little bit late. And considering that Wednesday is always a very busy day. But we take your apologies, sir, but we hope that it doesn't happen again. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you very much, Rabu Kalapa. We are happy that you have accepted our humble apology. It should not happen again. Now, in our agenda, we have a presentation of the white paper on South African foreign policy as the only substantive matter. Can we adopt this agenda or want to add or this item cannot expand bounds? Sekare is proposing for the adoption of the only substantive agenda item seconded by Honorable Halapa and seconded in silence by us. Honorable member. Thank you very much. Over to you, DG. I don't know who's going to speak, but you can interchangeably. We want to defend to you to make a presentation. Thank you.
Honorable Chair and honorable members, it is a great pleasure to come and present to the Honorable Committee. I'm here on behalf of the DG, who is the chairman for the G20 taking place in Brisbane, Australia. And I'm with Mr. Fadl Nasiruddin, who is going to assist me in presenting this white paper to the committee. If I'm allowed, Chair, may I then give over to Mr. Nasiruddin to take the committee through. I thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Thank you, Honorable Members, and thank you, Acting DG. Honorable Members, it is indeed a great pleasure for me personally to be here to present. As Honorable Members may be aware, this has been a fairly long process of drafting, consultations, etc. So I'm indeed happy that you are here to finalize the process of this white paper, which had been something that has been long overdue for JERCO to have, since we haven't really, since 1994, had a white paper, but we had a green paper, as you may well be aware. Our green paper was, in fact, finalized in 1996, but we never really finalized that process into a white paper until 2010, when our minister again reiterated the necessity of looking at the advancing expectations on South Africa to continue to play a leading role, and the reassessment of our foreign policy, and the fact that we have, in fact, not codified these enduring principles and values that inform our foreign policy and the conduct of our international relations. So we started that process with consultations with various sectors of civil society, academic, business, etc., labor, and so forth. So we started the consultation and then went through a round of drafting, which included the process of bringing in from the various branches within our department inputs into a base document which tries to map out the work that we do on a daily basis within the department, and to then match the work that we do as a department with the principles and the values that we use in the conduct of diplomacy. And that process then went through to the actual drafting of a base document, which was then again taken through rounds of consultation with the civil society sectors. Now, the white paper itself tries to outline the both principles and elements of our foreign policy, and to therefore lay and map out a framework in which we then conduct our work. And as such, it therefore clarifies both the role of our department as well as the mandate of the department. But of course, in doing so, while it cannot cover the operational day-to-day issues of our work, what it does do is it allows us to work within a framework to address the current initiatives within government, such as Outcome 11, which refers to the work of our department, and of course the NDP and other instruments, the annual APPs that we have. All of these are therefore in alignment with this, because this is a broad framework within which we then conduct the work, which is, if I can use the quotation that the department always refers to, which is to have a better South Africa and a better Africa and a better world. Now, looking at the document itself, the white paper, I think I want to just draw attention to elements of the way the white paper is structured. It gives a bit of a background through the introduction in terms of how it links to the post-1994 environment and the transition into a new foreign policy in the post-1994 domestic environment and South Africa's entry into, as it were, the family of nations again. And then looking at the department within that framework, what is our mandate? And then goes back to mapping out these values and interests that I mentioned. And this is important because I think really at the heart of the white paper and the intention that those of us who drafted the white paper really wanted to do was for the department to create an enduring basis where reference could always be made to the important values and principles that we established in 1994 that informed the conduct of our foreign policy. We then take a look at the drivers and the trends in the global system. And I'll allude to that a little bit later again. But this is the part where often I think some debate arises as to whether the white paper is current, whether it addresses certain things. And I think here really the important thing is that you really identify the most basic elements of what in this era is driving forward international relations. Of course, some of these things amend and change slightly, but what this is meant to be is the backdrop to say this is the environment in which international relations is conducted, and the trajectories in which certain things will continue, and therefore this is how it will impact on South Africa and how we should therefore proceed without going into necessary specific details, because then the white paper itself will date very quickly. Then we look then at, in that context, how do we position South Africa within the global community, and how we can take our diplomacy forward. some of the key concepts that you throw out the paper that I think are important to note is that first and foremost, our foreign policy is a protection of our domestic policy. Our domestic imperatives, the priorities that we have in the country, has to be the basis of our foreign policy at all times. And I think this needs to be set upfront because many questions that sometimes arise about particular actions and specific operational issues sometimes do not take into account that that is a fundamental aspect of our foreign policy. Secondly, it acknowledges the interconnectedness, the relationships between interests and values. And again, this is, I think, later perhaps in our discussion, this will also come up, is the importance of balancing our interests and our values. And also often, I think, the interests are highlighted, and necessarily so because countries have interests, but we need to really look critically also at who we are as a country, as a nation, how we project ourselves to the outside world, and what gives us the leverage that we have. And as we look, for instance, now at the legacy of Madiba, and as people again start to talk about how we will continue that legacy for a new generation, when I listen to this, I hear people talk about the values. And so it is important when we look at how the outside world views us and talks about that legacy, that we do not, for lack of a better word, undervalue the values that we are expected to cherish and the values that South Africa is meant to project. And so striking the balance between our interests out there and the values that we must project as a nation, as a country, is critical. But we'll discuss that a little bit, but I wanted to highlight that as a key throughout the paper as well. And bringing all of that together, I must say the draft has really deliberated a lot about this because we expected that there would be some debate about what is South African diplomacy and what is South Africa as a country, what is our value proposition to the rest of the world. Why is South Africa, as some people say, punching above its weight? And we say, no, we're not. You're punching above your weight means you belong in a different category, but you're acting in this one. And we say, no, we're not. But then what is it that puts us in this other category, for instance, is our weight? And that is that South Africa's values, that South Africa's history, that the soft power, if I can use international relations, our soft power is what elevates us to that higher category. And so when we look at what is it that holds our foreign policy together, it cannot be the traditional concept such as small power, which really is a term, for instance, the United States uses that term to describe its own foreign policy. And they use that term to mean that, yes, you negotiate, yes, you speak, but you might always have the military and the economic power to back it up so that you can act in order to ensure that your interests are secured. South Africa doesn't act in that way. South Africa doesn't have hard power necessarily to do that. In fact, South Africa speaks of collaboration. South Africa brings people together. South Africa always tries to have a situation where negotiations and collaboration are the outcomes without necessarily using force to do so. And so without that, again, if our foreign policy is a projection of our domestic policy, then what the world looks on as a so-called miracle of 1994, then it was the triumph of the spirit of Ubuntu. And if that is so prevalent as to who we are as a nation, we should be proud to project that to the outside world to our foreign policy. And this is why we felt strongly that it is indeed a context on which we should frame our projection to the world and pronounce our foreign policy as being pivoted around that. So what are these foreign policy pillars then that our foreign policy rests on? I can best describe it as concentric circles, really. We start with that, but of course, in broad terms, it is the African continent that is our immediate neighbor, and therefore takes a priority in terms of our foreign engagement. And this, of course, is manifested in how high South Africa's investment is on the continent, in direct investment and trade, etc. But it is also in terms of South African engagement, peacekeeping, South Africa's active role in elections, promoting elections, monitoring elections, supporting humanitarian activities and so on. Then beyond Africa, it is the South, and by the South we mean of course the developing countries who have a shared cause with South Africa in terms of dealing with underdevelopment, poverty, and some of the common constraints that we have. Then, beyond that, we look at the North and how we promote dialogue with partnership with developed countries. And then, of course, the multilateral system, where we deal with all countries but on particular issues, whether it's climate change, whether it's human rights and so forth, where South Africa is a very strong voice in terms of transforming the system of global governance, in terms of leading developing countries, bless you. And so the multilateral system is essential. And then, of course, South Africa has a voice for promoting global equity and social justice. So these are some of the things, the key pillars. So if we map out how we conduct our foreign policy, those would be the pillars on which it rests. Now, what are some of the principles that we follow in terms of carrying out that foreign policy? Number one, states are interdependent. In other words, we need each other. So I think it cannot on its own say, well, we better plan our neighbors, let's look at our own economy, etc. The world doesn't work that way, and so any state that thinks it can do that will learn very quickly, and as you know, even the big powers now have to reach out to everybody. Secondly, as I mentioned earlier, as in our foreign policy, cooperation has to drive over competition, and collaboration has to drive over confrontation. This is central to our conduct in our foreign policy as we engage other nations, whether it is in conflict situations or whether it is just in our normal bilateral relations. We really believe that nations and states need to cooperate with each other in a competitive environment, but that we should seek collaboration rather than confrontation, especially in military terms and so forth. So even within peacemaking and peacekeeping, these are the principles that endure. Of course, we also draw from a rich history of internationalism, of pan-Africanism, of solidarity among developing countries of the South. In our rejection of all forms of colonialism and oppression. And South Africa continues to be a voice for those who still suffer under some of these forms of oppression. And then, of course, South Africa pursues a quest for the unity, economic, political, and social renewal of our continent, which, as I said earlier, remains at the top of our agenda. We are committed to partnerships with the North, as well as, of course, partnerships with the South, as you know, IFA, BRICS, etc. But the partnerships with the North remain important. In terms of our development trajectory, need to ensure that we work with our developed country partners and that we bring them in because they play an important role in our development in terms of resources, expertise, technology, etc. But the important thing to emphasize here is the nature of the partnership. Whereas it used to be a donor-recipient relationship, what has drastically changed over the last decade, I could say, is that our narrative and engagement with our partners from the North has changed much more towards genuine partnership rather than dictating terms of giving to a recipient country in the South with conditionality and all the problems that have come with that. Of course, we have to promote the eradication of poverty around the world. It is no longer, I think, valid to say that we will alleviate poverty, but of course, it is a long-term process, and as such, on an annual basis, we seek to alleviate poverty in the work that we do towards the eventual eradication of poverty. We oppose inequality, the abuse of power in the international system, which is why we call as a country very loudly, I should say, for the reform of the UN, the UN Security Council, the World Bank, or the Bretton Woods institutions as we refer to both the IMF and the World Bank, and so forth, because we feel it's important that developing countries have a stronger say and representativity, not only in the organizations, but in the decisions especially that they make. and then, of course, pursue democracy or greater participation in the international system of governance through these multilateral bodies. Now, the driving themes that I referred to earlier, I said that these are really put in the paper in non-specific terms because we look at a very long-term trajectory. If one looks at some of the drivers of international dynamics, the more specific you become, the shorter time period to which you can then project. I don't say forecast because that is not what we do. We don't try to predict what's going to happen, but rather to look at what are the ways in which certain things will evolve within the international system that will have repercussions on the conduct of international relations. And so what we've really looked at are these main factors, and I think they still hold true from the day we wrote them, and I'm pretty confident they will certainly still remain as they are in the next 5-10 years. The specifics under them may change slightly. So with the demographics, we all know that this is important for our continent, the youth bulge as we refer to it, the fact that African population is going to be an important driver in terms of attracting investment, etc. But those are also important first implications. In order to derive the benefit of the total African population as a viable market, as a dynamic for growth, etc., the policy decisions that need to be taken are not only by South Africa, but by governments on the continent in terms of education, in terms of health, etc., will be important. So those are the more operational issues if you break down demographics. I'm not going to break down each one, but I'm just using it as an example to show that demographics will be an important player. But certain things can change. If we don't do enough about Ebola, it could impact on population size. If we don't tackle HIV/AIDS properly, these are things that can impact and so on. And if you don't manage your youth in terms of inclusiveness, jobs, etc., education, you can have political instability that comes from it. So demographics itself tells us that it's going to be the trajectory of growth in population. We have all the positives that are often referred to. But those positives depend on the policy decisions that governments take now in order to ensure that we arrive at that positive outcome, because the opposite can also do. Secondly, the realignment of economic power. This has been much written about, you know, the BRICS phenomenon, especially China, possibility, are we entering a new Cold War with Russia, the US, etc., and so on. Innovation, technology playing a critical role, especially again on our continent, the ability to leapfrog through communications and so on. And new media and social networks is playing a critical role. Well, some found that the Arab Spring didn't materialize in the way that it was foreseen, and that the Occupy movement, etc., didn't necessarily achieve the social revolution that was anticipated. I think this is, from as a researcher, I should say, that may be a short-term perspective. The longer term, that is actually something that needs to be looked at more carefully, that needs to be monitored, because it continues to resurface very quickly, and the ability of social media and social networks to mobilize people very quickly, we see this now more often, how quickly that can lead to even changes in government. Again, it's an important thing that we really need to take note of. Environmental change, I read an article about 2 days ago where a prominent scientist was speaking at the conference, saying that we must stop talking about climate change as something that will happen. It is happening. And the examples that they referred to were on our continent, where already farmers are saying the crops are not the way it used to be, and they can talk about and they go up how the land was fertile, etc. Now, you know, because of the irregular rain and access to other things, all of this is changing. So environmental change is there. We need to act on it. Heightened demand of scarce resources. I think that's one of the critical things. When we talk about the growth trajectories, Africa rising, etc., that rising is going to depend on economic growth. But economic growth is going to depend on our ability to produce products that others want to buy. It's going to depend on our ability to create jobs. All of those things depend on the resources, metals, changing, you know, I know into an economic vehicle, etc. Those resources are limited, they are finite. There's only so much copper underground, there's only so much gold, and so forth. So that's why innovation and technology is such a game changer, because in the north already the change to a knowledge economy means that they're not as dependent on necessarily raw minerals as they are on using, for instance, software. You don't need actual hard resources for that. But for us, as a continent and as a country, it means that whilst we agree on a huge amount of the world's natural resources, and that gives us an important leverage in terms of being a voice, in terms of what our value proposition is to the rest of the world, we must manage that very carefully. It is the family silverware which we should not squander. And then changing the nature, the changing nature of conflict and insecurity. We can see that it's no longer traditional wars where two countries go on an open field and the two armies face each other and they fight until the end of the day and see who is left standing. Conflict has changed completely. Cyber warfare is something which we're looking at in the department now, for instance, because we need to become more aware of how governments can be sabotaged by other governments, not necessarily only by terrorists, cyber terrorists, but by our governments even. And the example that I can use, for instance, with Iran and the ability of another government to have sent in a virus that completely brought the standstill in the nuclear program. And they were able to bring this in by having many people at the conference get memories, you know, the free memories we all get when we visit other people. And it actually didn't affect anybody. Somehow the virus knew when it was. In Iran, when it was put in by machine, he suddenly activated it up, and everybody else is all walking around with it, probably don't even know it's on their memory stick. And we're discussing this in the department as well as DMS. And that was so well designed. Once the Russian scientists to do a presentation, they can do it today with a memory stick. In this case, imagine if this thing was running in parliament, so that when it's copied here, it will affect everybody in the parliament to stand. And what it was in Iran, it actually brought the nuclear program to stand. Of course, Iran couldn't tell the world that, so they had to keep it quiet, although they were the victim of it. It's our common knowledge, and it was understood that Israel and the U.S. Had designed this specifically. What I'm alluding to is the complex and sophisticated nature of how conflict is not dealt with. Most of the time, it's not for that kind of thing. What's happening is much more where countries have comparative advantage in particular sectors of designing things, of advanced technologies, etc. It's a kind of espionage where things are then copied and very quickly produced elsewhere. Now, how does South Africa in this environment that I just talked about with all the changes, so how do we position South Africa given that we are an upper middle income nation? Well, our vision, first of all, is to be a successful, influential, and leading member of the international community. We support and need to be supported by a globally competitive economy, which will put us on a growth path that is sustainable. We've made significant inroads over the 20 years, and a lot of discussions are going on about the government, how much we've done in terms of dealing with unemployment, inequality, and poverty. In some cases, we've done better than in other cases, those particulars, but the vision remains that we have to make serious inroads in that. And our foreign policy certainly has a projection about domestic priorities, has to take this into account in terms of how we engage our partners from the north as well as from the south. And then, of course, we have to contribute to the development of our region, that is the SADC, the South African region, as well as the African continent as a whole. Now, thanks be to our engagement in international relations, as I mentioned earlier, was the fact that Africa is our backyard, Africa is our continent, we are part of the continent, and therefore we have to ensure that we, in our foreign policy, put this as a central pillar. Now, if we take the point of departure that our development is intricately intertwined with that of the continent, then it is easier to understand why our progress is going to be dependent on the fact that immediately across our borders we have peace and stability, that we have mutual development, etc. If we are going to escape some of the problems that we're already starting to see, which is, for instance, illegal migration to South Africa. We're talking about guns now in the media, and why all these weapons are coming to South Africa, and so forth. So I think we can see that it is necessary for us to have greater synergy with our neighbors and have faster regional integration as an important element of our own growth. And for that, we really need to work more closely with SADC, as we are doing, but probably would have to try and speed up the progress of data integration within SADC. And this is important both at the socio-economic level, but also at the political level and security level as well. I mentioned some of the issues on the continent as a whole earlier on, but I'm not going to go into detail on that, other than to say, of course, the African agenda is not something that we should see simply as something that we study. I think it's important to note that our efforts in all that we do, even when we're working outside of the continent, within BRICS, for example, we will champion Africa and Africa's development. When we are at the United Nations, we consult with the Africa Group first, etc. So Africa, even when it's not visible, I think, in the public eye or the honorable members, we continue to always put Africa's issues side by side with South Africa's issues and pursuit in terms of pursuing a common agenda. Our development partnerships with the rest of the world, including with the global north, is important, and what we are doing to try and bring greater synergy, simplicity, I suppose I should say, because it gets quite complex in the way we deal with countries. Some countries we have education, trade, etc., and then with other countries it might be culture, cultural operation, as well as education. So it becomes quite a complex web, and what South Africa, what ZERCO is now doing is in the process of finalizing the establishment of the South African Development Partnership Agency, SADPA. And this will be the instrument through which we can centralize this and try to make it a smoother process and to facilitate greater cooperation in a centralized way through government and through our department with all these various partners and the multiple layers on which we collaborate with each other. Multilateralism, as I said, is important. Again, I'm not going to go through all of these. I've mentioned some of these. Suffice to say, South Africa remains very active in the G20, as our acting DG pointed out earlier. The post-2015 development agenda, that is hosting a series of consultations with various civil society commissions, with other government departments, with other governments as well. So there's a series of workshops happening as we speak in ZERCO and coordinated by our department to try and develop a national understanding of the post-2015 development agenda, but also in order to better be informed on how we should influence the African position and therefore take a collective decision forward. And this is important because this is comes back to that development partnerships that I referred to earlier, where much of this debate is going to be well extent. We are able to champion the development priorities of our continent and countries of the South vis-a-vis the challenges that our countries in the North face. As we know, countries in the North now also have to contend with high unemployment, for instance, competing for markets there, and especially for our producers, the fact that their markets are tied up is a huge issue, and so they're turning inwards and trying to keep competition out and those kind of things. So there are very serious issues that need to be negotiated and which we need to work together with our partners on the continent and in the South on. So a lot of that discussions and consultations are happening. The reform of the basin with the institution must have been said about that. South Africa has survived in the UN Security Council and continue to champion not only the issues that we have traditionally championed within the multilateral context, but also in terms of Africa's priorities, especially given that in the UN Security Council, most of the issues that are dealt with are in fact African issues. So we continue to also push for the Bretton Woods institutions, the World Bank, the IMF to be reformed, and we will continue to do so. As we saw again today, the rating agencies and so on have great impact when their analysis shows it has great impact on the country and the growth trajectory that we forecast. Keep in mind here that the NDP, for instance, requires us to grow at a certain percentage every year. So every year that we deviate from that trajectory, the gap is bigger in terms of us not achieving where we want to be in 2030. And so these perceptions that might be out there, or some of the issues that are correctly pointed out to us, need to be factored in terms of how we then engage with these international institutions. I've mentioned the G20, BRICS, IPSA. The basic point I think that's important here is that South Africa has bilateral relations with most countries, as the Honourable Bennett might be aware. Pretoria is the second largest capital for foreign representation after Washington. And that, I think, shows how seriously the world takes us. So at bilateral level, we have excellent relations with most countries, but we also put a high premium on our multilateral relations. And this is important because we have to keep in mind that at a bilateral level, one country might be more powerful than another country and therefore able to pursue their interests, given the leverage that they have in the bilateral relationship. At the UN, apart now from the UN Security Council, but certainly within the confines of the General Assembly and other multilateral groupings, the smallest of countries, the Sotho, Swaziland, have one vote, whereas the US also has one vote. And so it's important at the multilateral level for smaller countries, for developing countries, for weaker countries, for poorer countries, to try and find collectives within which to act because that gives them stronger leverage. And so South Africa puts a strong premium on that in order to champion the causes of developing countries. Economic diplomacy. This is, diplomacy has many features. One can speak of cultural diplomacy, one can speak of, this is all, as a researcher, I'm even myself sometimes surprised how many diplomacies there can be. But there's no question that a feature of the conduct of diplomacy has always been the pursuit of economic interests. And in the current situation after especially 2008, it has become important for all countries, not just countries of the South, to pursue economic interests and how best to position the country in terms of global markets, in terms of increasing trade flows, attracting investment, etc. And this, for South Africa, clearly is important given the imperatives contained in the NDP, as well as government's current programs, including the very latest Operation Pakistan and so forth. All of these need to find its way in how our embassies, our ambassadors, our diplomats engage internationally in order for us to have the relations, whether it's multilateral or bilateral, that will promote our sustained development. I'm not going to go through those details. At the bilateral level, the department has branches and desks that deal with the different regions globally and the countries within those regions. The Asia branch deals with countries of the Middle East as well. Europe and the Americas deal with the countries there at the bilateral level. But of course, we also engage them multilaterally when we encounter those countries in the G20 and other forums. And like I said, what you end up with is a very complex web of relationships where in some instances we would be like-minded on particular issues with, let's say, a fellow European country, and in another forum on a different issue we might have very different views on those issues. The key question for our diplomat is how to manage those so that the relationships are able to continue to go forward on the issues that we agree on without being polluted too much by the issues on which we disagree on, and to find mechanisms and ways to manage those issues where we have disagreements, such as we have, for instance, with the EU on trade issues. So how do we take our diplomacy forward? Well, first of all, at the domestic level, we have a consultative way of working with various sectors of society. One of my jobs, for instance, in the department is to assist our principals on some of the outreach programs. I also work with my unit in close collaboration, especially with academia and the universities, because that's where a lot of the research happens. But of course, we also bring in from time to time the private sector, labor, and other civil society formations, NGOs, on particular issues, or where they've been maybe on Somalia, for instance, or where they on a particular issue, which I just mentioned, cybersecurity. The people do the research out there, I would bring them in, we have focus groups, roundtable discussions, we determine what would be the appropriate platform, and we engage with them. Public diplomacy is, of course, the other way in which we deal with the public in terms of creating understanding of the work we do and providing explanations for issues that are raised on a day-to-day basis in foreign policy and our engagement internationally. And then, of course, we have for the various sphere of government the consultative forum on international relations, which meets once or twice a year, where we essentially bring in the international relations heads of the government departments, as well as those who work at the provincial level, and in some cases the cities also have people specifically dedicated to that. And then we are now finalizing, and again, our unit, the Policy Research and Analysis Unit, is also tasked with the establishment of the South African Council on International Relations, which is a body that would advise the minister and would draw from members who are from various sectors of civil society. That basically, in honorable members, is how we bring together the domestic component in terms of consultation, inclusiveness, etc., on how we conduct our foreign policy and how we then project that into our international relations. Perhaps I think DG, if I can just say one last word about the white paper, is that given the processes that we went through over this lengthy period, one of the things that I think needs to be kept in mind is we often have, let's say, in the case of academia or the business sector, when we consult with them, one of the difficulties is often that we speak of them as if they are a bloc that has a uniform approach to everything. And this is not necessarily the case. Business tries to speak with one voice, but various business have very different issues, and therefore their approach would be different. So for example, if we speak to business, the auto industry would want us to open markets and allow trade to go in and out with no interference at all. But in the same room, if we had those who work in the manufacturing, and especially the textile industry, they would insist that South Africa needs to be more protectionist, that we need to close our borders to those who produce certain things. And understandably so. They're speaking for their sectors, they're speaking for their businesses, and for the people they employ, etc. We have the difficult task of listening to business and bringing together the various views and making a recommendation that will take us forward, and balancing between those different views. But now, that is business. If we then bring labor in, then they have an entirely different approach to all of this. So this paper is necessarily going to be the outcome of an arduous process of listening, of trying to find the balance between what we see ourselves as a nation going forward, and how we see that balance between the articulated needs of the various sectors of our society. I therefore expect that there would be, I suppose, criticism from the various sectors, because you're not going to please everybody. What we hope to do is that we strike a fine balance that at least takes us forward in a way that helps those sectors through our conduct in international relations and foreign policy, and to support the NDD and support the growth trajectory that we have set ourselves as a country, and that while doing so, we remain true to the values and principles that is that important component that I spoke about earlier in projecting our foreign policy. Chairperson, I thank you, and I will leave it there.
Thank you very much for your presentation. I will now, let me take I wanted to say, let me take my rightful place, but I just thought it's very arrogant to think that when I sit here, actually a rightful place. It's a privilege to be here, so. But in politics, there's something called strategic sitting. And I'm seated very strategic here to see everybody. Thank you very much. DDG, do you want to make any item? Covered. Okay. Panel members, we have taken an elaborate, I would imagine, discussion on South Africa's white paper on foreign policy. And as members would remember, when we proposed to your good self, we said that the white paper was developed over time, and it was then presented to cabinet, and cabinet approved the white paper. We then said, because we are in the fifth parliament, and some, if not most of us, are new in the portfolio of international relations, we needed the department to walk us through the principle or the key features that inform South Africa's foreign policy. And because from time to time, there is sometimes praise for what South Africa is doing outside the country, but there's also criticism of what South Africa is doing outside the country. It doesn't matter where. Now, we then said it would be bad if members of the portfolio committee themselves are not educated. Then I can mention just a few within the African continent. The Central African Republic, when our soldiers died there, people started to say, what did they want there in the first instance? Recently, the issue of Nigeria, I know it's not an issue of diplomacy, but people are asking whether the Nigerian God is better than the South African God. Questions like that. Why don't you bring that God from Nigeria to South Africa? Our silent diplomacy then, I don't know what it is now, our so-called silent diplomacy, quiet, yeah, on Zimbabwe. I remember President Day would say, no, we don't want mega diplomacy for Zimbabwe. Issues about the Sutra and others. No, this one, you don't have to write down. I'm just saying, the criticism and the praise, I'm just teasing out things that were there. The issue of our participation in BRICS, what do we get there because we're a small brother or sister? What a small ass there in the BRICS. Things like that. And our impact or otherwise on global governance system, like the reform or transformation of the security council, whether we are in fact seeking a reform and or a transformation, all of the things like that. Yeah, but I'm going to defer to the member to ask some questions, and I will be the last to attempt to say something. And Honorable Mukhalapa,
wants to have the first bite.
Thank you very much, Chair. I think in a nutshell, you have quite attempted to summarize the issues that come around when it comes to foreign policy. And yes, the consensus is very much worth, because of you got to have a fine balance between what is happening. Because of the first question that has been asked was that, why do we have to have a foreign policy? Because of this world is fluid. So it changes over time. So you might be tied by a foreign policy that might be outdated tomorrow. And when you have a situation the day after. So what is the logic of having that? And the link to that was the issue of whether do we have continuity or do we have something new, because of there being an indication of the faces of South Africa's foreign policy from the former President Mandela's human rights up until the African Renaissance of President Mbeki, and then currently now the one that is focusing on economic diplomacy. So those are the critical impediments of our foreign policy. Coming to the question at hand, there is criticism that the definition of Ubuntu is inconsistent or not clear, because of what do we mean by Ubuntu? And we are saying we are for cooperation and collaboration. What happens when we got confronted with confrontation? And how do we stay true to our principles of human rights, equality before the law, rule of law, respect for international law, and all those things? What does Ubuntu come? Does it come as just an abstract term, or does it have a concrete meaning of our foreign policy? Linked to that is this stormy issue of national interest. What are our national interests? Yes, we know poverty, we know unemployment, we know inequality. But does our foreign policy define what constitutes our national interest moving forward? If you find any layman on the street and you say, what is South Africa's national interest? Will that person boldly say, this is what? And that's the concern that you were talking about when you said, you know, in your consultation broadly, you would get to a challenge where the others would say, let's go for protectionism. Some would say, let's go for the open. And you know, what is the definition of national interest should be coming from? And then the issue of the South-South relations. There is a view that it looks as if we would want to close our economy towards the South, while neglecting the traditional North. And when we're talking about issues of jobs, investment, foreign direct investment, looking for economic growth, that is where the potential comes in. But the way we are crafting our policy, it means as if we are aligning towards the South with the neglect of the North. While that means we are closing our economy. And, you know, your response in that one. And as far as the Council of International, the SACPA, the clarity is just on the issue of saying, is it a consultative or advisory, or is it policy making? Because it's different dynamics. Because of foreign policy by its nature is being conducted by the president. It's you know, with implementation from the department. And when you have another advisory body that can have policy-making implications, then it's a mushy world, because of where will this SACPA report to DICO or to the president? Because that is where the thing. And then obviously the devil is always on the implementation and the budget and the funding of the whole SACPA. Then lastly, on let me touch on the issue of economic diplomacy. There's been a call to say economic diplomacy to what end, and what does it mean? Because of whether do we go for commercial diplomacy or economic diplomacy? Because of when you talk of economic diplomacy, it's not only about the access to the market, but it's about how do we influence, for example, the World Trade Organization
how do we influence all those decisions that make sure that we have tourism and investment coming to our shore. And that leads to what is a modern foreign mission should be looking like and what should be doing, apart from the traditional consular service and, you know, meet and greet services. What should a foreign, a modern foreign mission do right after the issue of this dynamics of the changing world and the issue of economic diplomacy that we need to do? But to what end are we talking about? And, you know, the African Renaissance is always a fun one. Is it about continuity of the NEPAD and the ARTM, or is it something new in terms of our focus and attention to Africa? Are we moving away from the project that we started of African Renaissance and NEPAD towards something that is new? Thank you, Chef. Let me pause there and give my colleagues an opportunity.
Honorable
Aya.
Thanks, Chairman. Chairman, let me start first by welcoming the presentation. And just to say, my major observation, I might be wrong, is that our relationship with the BRICS countries sometimes is perceived as if we are neglecting other players in the African continent. And as a result, they start also making other alliances with other countries. So I would like to understand whether these people will actually be able to address such fears. I think that's just the chairperson. Chairperson, I wanted to apologize, man. I had a clashing committees just to request to attend to another portfolio committee on that. If it...
No, thank you very much, Honorable Maila. I'm aware that you and Honorable Mbumlwana also serve in the Justice Committee. Sometimes we sit at the same time. And yours is always a very unenviable situation where you have to attend to both of them. You are elite.
Okay.
We'll listen on your behalf.
Yeah, not because you do that.
Thank you very much for the presentation, and I think it's very explicit. The Ubuntu diplomacy, and I think it's a continual learning, observation, influencing, you know, in order to make Africa and the world a better place to be on. And what is my interest is in page 16 on the reform of the United Nations and the Bretton Woods institutions. If we can really unpack what actually with this proven diplomacy is you want to share on. I think that is it from me.
Okay.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for the presentation. My few questions. One is about, and you say that on the first page 2, you talked about the Green Paper on Foreign Policy, which was finalized in 1996. During the panel here, we were told that as South Africa, we have got 7 foreign policy documents. Yes, I understand. We are not going to change anything except that for interest sake, you want to check and know that this paper has already been endorsed by the cabinet, but that for interest sake. Though maybe some of you were not there at the time, but that maybe because you have got the archives, maybe you learned something from the archives. What I want to know, were those extracts evaluated, inputs evaluated, so that you check the relevancy of the input now. We started then in 1996 during President Adiba's time. So, secondly, and you said that South Africa faces challenges on balancing its national interests against global realities in a rapidly changing world. Will our policy be able to address and manage these dynamics? And thirdly, talking about South Africa's white paper, as that we said, it reflects why I'm about to tell you guys by the country with regions like Asia, East, etc., and Europe. Now, I just want to check, because you said that we make also engage the academia of universities. The academics here, when they were here in the panel, they were complaining about their input, which was not taken into consideration. So, therefore, I just want to check if in this policy document there are some things they have been attended to. Thank you, Chairperson.
Honourable Kalia.
Thank you, Chairperson. I would like to know whether DIRCL has made any formal proposals around the reform of the United Nations. Because you say that should be looked at, and I'd like to know whether any formal proposal has been made. I also want to know, what is the difference between the Consultative Forum on International Relations and SACO? You want to establish SACO. Can you hear me? You want to establish SACO, but yet we do have this consultative forum. Who sits on the consultative forum? Why do you feel the need to have an additional body? And what role do you think it's going to be? Is it going to be similar to the South African National AIDS Council, which is an advisory body? Or will it be also responsible for looking at legislation for DECO? So that would be my two questions. I'm still not so sure that we have arrived at a proper definition of Ubuntu and economic diplomacy. I think that's just our theory out on it, but I think the document kind of starts to harness, if you use it in a particular context, this is what it would mean, and if you use it in another context, that is what it would mean. Those are my few comments and questions.
Thank you very much, Honourable Members. On the issue that you think can only be answered by your political principles, such as the minister or any of the deputy ministers, do indicate that it is this matter we think can best be handled by one of the political principals, and they do advise them that we would want some clarity around those matters. And as within any, but we can find time and space for explanations like that to be made to members of the committee. Well, I have almost similar comments as those presented by the member. I also hold the view that the codification of the foreign policy of a country is good and bad. It is good if it will inform everybody in cabinet and everybody in the South African context, everybody in cabinet and everybody in the provinces and everybody in the academia and parliament and anyone who interacts with people from outside to say, where do we stand as South Africans on certain issues, on the principal values and principles it's good in that sense, but it is bad in that then your documents will be read by other countries. They read your countries, they see therefore where do you stand, then they abuse you sometimes for holding those kind of positions, which you may not change, but you may still speak to certain things like, but your view is this one. And obviously, a foreign policy will be what? It will be, I want to say something and say time. It will be passed by time. If your foreign policy, for instance, is written in 1996, in 2014, the world has changed irrevocably. And this one, for instance, is written in 1912 and adopted by cabinet. There are so many changes, there are invasions of other countries, there is the rise of militarism or unilateralism, both of them actually. There is the rise of unilateralism, acting outside the United Nations and other multi-fora, and the rise of militarism by certain things. Now, things like that, and if your foreign policy, if you stick to it, it may not be able to assist you. There's a shift in terms of economic balance of forces, and trade balances. Now, if your policy is that Europe is very important, Africa is very important, then there are emerging economic groupings like the TVEX, BRICS, for instance, has just come into form. You've got the TVEX, and some of the countries within BRICS or some of the countries within TVEX may also be members of other groupings, and they may influence certain positions within these groupings. For instance, if Brazil becomes a member of another grouping, they may want to influence certain positions in BRICS that are actually going to benefit them in terms of trade in another grouping, things like that. Does our foreign policy allow for those kind of flexibilities? I agree with the main core values and principles that you've alluded to, the Pan-Africanism broadly, internationalism, solidarity, partnership, Ubuntu, all of those I think are very, very important. But I also want to add my voice that perhaps you may need to dedicate a whole chapter on Ubuntu. But if we say the name of our foreign policy, and if we say the American foreign policy is smart diplomacy, and we say ours is diplomacy of Ubuntu, then it must be sufficiently articulated, and it must be understood by the presidency, by parliament, by minister. When we say diplomacy of Ubuntu, in its geostrategic sense, this is what it allows us to do or not to do. In its economic stroke commercial diplomacy, this is what diplomacy of Ubuntu does, we can do or will do. In our engagement with the South-South relations, this is what it will mean. This is what it will mean when we engage in the different multi-fora, G20, G77, WTO. For now, our criticism is very fair that it is poorly articulated. Halapa was saying, does it mean that we cannot make a military intervention if Ubuntu is associated with kindness, with meekness, with inability to be not assertiveness, in other words. Does it mean that people can look down upon you as they think, or as they people, and you say, no, I'm Latina? Because the diplomacy of Ubuntu comes from the word Ubuntu or Ubuntu. Now, you don't have an equivalent, and I keep on saying it, you don't have an equivalent of this in English or Afghan. It's not humanness. It is all about men's legacy. It is not. It is not. So, Ubuntu, people. Ubuntu is far more very deep.
Yeah.
There are, I once saw a book, it's a book written by Tutu. I don't know which one, where he was also talking about Ubuntu. And he attempted a few things that he was also saying. So we need to borrow quite a lot of information and kind of get some academic research over a year or two, and then see how we can apply that concept to our diplomas. But my view is that it would be good to brand our diplomas as diplomas of Ubuntu. So this is what we stand for. You know, what it will encompass is human rights, democracy, participation of citizens, you know, a just world order. All of this must be embodied there. It's just that we need to articulate it far more deeply in the document so that it informs us of something. But there is another witness that has been said by both my colleagues and other people that our foreign policy, or sometimes even the department itself, is perceived to be elitist and doesn't reach out to provinces, particularly some people who matter in the province, the mayors, the mayoral committee. Do they know what the core interest of South Africa, core interest or core interest is? That, you see, when it comes to this, you don't touch. You know, somebody once told me that when it comes to Tibet, China doesn't pass. You can talk about everything else, but don't tell them that Tibet will be allowed to secede. They are no longer their side. It's like us saying that, talk about everything, but don't say that Robben Island will be given to somebody else. Because it's part of our core value. So the explanation of our core values to university principals and other people who form important bodies of opinion is very, very important, as well as people on the ground generally. But it is something that we can all attend to, because that criticism that we may be giving to the department is actually a criticism we should also give to the members of parliament. Because while on the one hand the members of parliament hold the department to account, but when it comes to them doing constituency work and engaging with people, those things that they already understand, they must also impart them to the people as an extension of their work of parliament or as part of their work of parliament. So it's a two-way kind of matter. I also want to know, does it mean what would have changed in terms of emphasis in our foreign policy? If you look at the 20 or 30 years before 1994, how did South Africa relate to the world? And or let's say 20 years before 1994 and 20 years later, what would be the main differences, qualitative differences? No, you see, you're apartheid South Africa, look at the world this way. And since 1994, we're looking at the world, engaging, we're relating with the world this way. Perhaps those about the Mandela administration, Bay, etc., etc., there would be continuity and change and change of emphasis on statements. But indeed, Mukhalapa was spot on in saying that there are people who think that with the departure of President Bay, in fact, I don't know why he pronounced that his name, the Bay, when he said Mbe. People say Masango to me, what Masango. Mbumalanga, Mbumalanga. No. Ubuti, he appeared on my sense. China is told is abandoned or is under accentuated. To a point where some people even think that he is the father of that concept, African migrant. That he founded it, he spoke about it, and then it was implemented, and from there arrived our new partnership for African development, the AFA Institute, and other things. And when he left the stage, then the whole thing has been abandoned. You see, that's why we need to explain to people. Perhaps the last one, and the very last one. Now, my sense is that since 1945, at least, democratic states have emerged, sovereign states, and up to 1994, now I'm talking about Africa, many countries have been decolonized. We still have just a few, we still have Palestine, we have Sahrawi, maybe not many people that are still ruled under other colonies. Now, the emphasis therefore on wealth diplomacy is not on political diplomacy. Therefore, it's all economic diplomacy. And if I'm correct in my view, that there's a lot of attention to seeking to get resources for themselves, for their own economic development, then it takes you back to more or less 1894 when there was a scramble for Africa. It does seem to me that there is a new scramble for resources in the world by either a country or a grouping of countries. And that makes economic diplomacy as well as commercial diplomacy very, very important for every country, because you might be outwitted if you don't know your story. And the people who are criticizing us, who pray, that's what they are saying. And I'm sorry, this is a political question for the political business. They say, what do we want in BRICS? Because China and India know exactly what they want there. In other words, we are a gateway into Africa. You know, we must legitimize their entry into Africa. And Africa is awash with mineral resources. South Africa itself, the DRC, and others, and most of them are not processed within the continent, but are unbeneficiated. Just get platinum as it is, then coal processes in ourselves, and that. They continue to deplete our resources. Therefore, if Africa and South Africa were to know their story, they would say, you don't touch this one, or this one will be done at home, we'll sell you a finished product. So, if I'm right in my analysis, it means both our president and the minister to whom the president has delegated this authority and our diplomats must be thoroughly schooled, must be alert about commercial diplomacy. And I spoke somewhere about economic diplomacy or trade, and someone said, no, it's not the same thing. Economic diplomacy is not the same as commercial stroke trade diplomacy. And but of course, thank God I'm not an ambassador. You see, I would have misrepresented a country. So clearly, there's a need to work hard on that front. Over to you. I'm sorry that I gave myself a lot of time. I'm not sure if it was it a bit of power.
thank you very much. But thank you for all these really important and interesting questions. The main question, and I'll ask the acting DD to come in to supplement where I may have not got the question correct, but I'll try to answer most of them as well as I can. I think most of the questions we can answer without having to resort to political principles, because some of these issues I know have been addressed also. Similarly through questions from the media and so forth, and through the public outreach that our ministers do from time to time. let me start with the question that was initially raised about why we have a foreign policy and whether foreign policy is outdated or whether there's continuity. Let me say the whole notion, even before the Westphalian system of nation states came about, there was the need for diplomacy. Kings, queens, rulers had envoys that they would send sometimes on long journeys to represent their interests, to take messages to other cultures and faraway lands, because it was important to try and get on the same page, as it were, on particular issues of conflict or agreement, respect for territorial boundaries, etc. But even before the nation states, it was necessary to have diplomacy. the Western, in terms of then should we have a policy that guides that? Well, in the case of a sovereign, king, ruler, without borders in those days, meant that the sovereign made the policy. So whatever the sovereign decided today, what policy, and tomorrow, that could be changed if the ruler felt necessary. But in the nation state, all things are guided by policy, and therefore, including foreign policy, but the health policy, space policy, etc., really is necessary to have a policy. The difficult dimension which Honourable Member raises then is, well, how do you prevent this from becoming outdated? And I think this is precisely why, in the beginning, I mentioned the one of the difficulties that we grappled with was to have a white paper that does not try to address the detailed operational issues of the conduct of international relations, but rather to have a paper that really pins down the values and principles that are enduring in our foreign policy. In other words, these are things I hope, even if they take on a different nuance 10 years, 20 years from now, that generations will be able to look back and say, since 1994, our new foreign policy that differentiates, and as the Honourable Chairperson pointed out, 20 years from now, 20 years before 1994. Scholars are now starting to look at how that transition, many books are coming out and enriching our understanding of how that transition happened and what it was that we transitioned from and what we transitioned to. And those details are going to necessarily be, I think, very important insights by people who were there who did these things. But all of us as citizens, we know that a significant change took place not only in foreign policy, but of course through all the policies of government. But in this context, in terms of foreign policy, what was it that significantly changed? And two broad areas that I alluded to that the paper tried to capture is, on the one hand, the values that we have, and the interest that we have, and how we pursue those interests. So whereas, for instance, the previous government had a very aggressive stance towards our neighbors in terms of pursuing its interests, in terms of protecting its interests, we now have a very different approach in how we engage our neighbors and the rest of our continent by balancing those values and interests. And of course, on a day-to-day basis, as should happen in a democracy, we will argue about those things. We'll debate as to whether we should have perhaps been more forceful in pursuing a particular interest, should we have been a bit more protectionist in a particular sector. That's how the debate will go. But this paper is not meant to tell us that. What the paper is meant to do is guide us by reminding us 5 years from now, 10 years from now, that the found principles on which our foreign policy draws have indeed got a rich history, and it has permeated through the various administrations that we've had. And I want to emphasize this point to a later question that was raised about the presidency. Yes, and Chris Landberg, Professor Landberg, wrote a book in which he, for instance, dealt with foreign policy in terms of the presidencies. And one of the criticisms I had of his book, and I've debated this with him, is that you look at our foreign policy from the various presidencies. And I've explained to him, and I accept this point, but for academic purposes, I had to try and illustrate the difference in orientation or nuance from President Mandela to President Becky and so on. And why I differ with having the foreign policy pass through the prism only is because the principles have remained the same. The nuance in how it is implemented may change, and that has various reasons. Let me give an example that was used by the Honourable Chair with President Becky. Yes, President Becky championed the Renaissance, President Becky championed Nepal, and to a certain extent embodied that trust. But President Becky had no influence over the fact that in a country like Nigeria, President Obatango was elected as president, or that in Senegal, a certain president was elected, or in Algeria. But those were all leaders who, through a confluence of coincidence, if you wish, a miracle, if you wish, had leaders who could come together and had the same vision for Africa and how Africa should be taken forward. And they became the locomotive that drove that phase of issues and imperatives for our continent. Now, had President Mbeki had the same vision, but the other leaders were not there, would they have been as successful in driving that? Probably not. So what I'm saying is, yes, we attribute to President Mbeki correctly that vision, that drive, But the other thing that was not necessarily of South Africa's making, or President Bay's making. And so the various places don't have to contend with an environment, and we are based in that place that we have to contend with an environment of which we do not have necessarily the power to influence as much as sometimes is credited to us. We're a middle power, as some people describe us, and it's a different debate as where we exactly, but we're an upper middle income country. And so we have to be modest about the influence that we can have. And this is also, again, why in the paper we say multilateralism is so important, because it gives us greater mass. It gives us a critical mass to influence policy decisions, etc. Through the fact that in a multilateral forum, let's say like the UN General Assembly, in the smallest country had one vote, and the United States also has one vote. So here the UN Security Council has a veto, but not in the General Assembly, and all other meetings of the General Assembly and some of the committee meetings, all countries have an equal vote. Now, let me therefore say, so yes, we have to read that policy. The policy should not come outdated, because policy shouldn't speak to issues of the day, but rather the enduring principles that inform how we respond to those issues on a day-to-day basis. And therefore, should not become outdated. I certainly hope that this paper will not become outdated in 5 years or 10 years, but I do believe that 10 years from now, it would be important for us to revisit this, to come before Parliament and say, has our foreign policy changed? Has the world changed so much that we may need to revisit these values and interests and say, is it necessary for us to keep them the same? But like in a country's constitution, we don't ask every day to be changed the constitution. There may be 20 years, 30 years, 40 years from now, we might want to say, does the constitution still reflect who we are in nation, and now there's some laws that may need to change? But it doesn't happen every day. And I hope that White Paper in particular will be something that has established, and I want to concede here that this should have been done in the mid-1990s. This is, like I said, it's long overdue. We should have captured those enduring principles in the 1990s to get our white paper. And then we would have based our conduct against this from then, and then we would have, I think, been in a best position. So, no, it's not abstract. On the contrary, it is very concrete, because these principles are applied daily. We evaluate what we do against those values, as well as our those interests. And we are expected not only as officials by our principles, but certainly by government through the presidency in terms of monitoring and evaluation and so forth, whether what we do delivers on the NDP, on the ITPs that we set, etc. And so these cannot be abstract, even if we wanted it to be. As much as I am a researcher in our department, I think my colleagues would think that I should belong in academia if I did not address that the issues that are in our ACP, in outcome 11, and so on, because we now have to fill in those documents and actually submit them to the presidency twice a year at least. On the question of the national interest, this comes up a lot, and we have taken the issue to Cabinet. There is a discussion. We've produced some discussion document through government and the processes in order to define more specifically what is our national interest. But perhaps more broadly speaking, for us and in the context of this paper, it is the promotion and the protection of the well-being of South Africa's citizens as well as those of our continent. And through the diplomacy of Ubuntu, what is very explicitly prevalent is the notion that we do not define our national interest in a narrow nationalistic way. This is a unique feature of South African foreign policy. In fact, if I can again take another question that came up, this branding of a foreign policy is a fairly unique thing. Most countries have a foreign policy document and it becomes a government document at a later time point. Some people will know, but it's not commonly accepted practice, honorable members, that the citizens of a country know their foreign policy inside out. Even in the United States, most people don't actually know their foreign policy. In fact, those who may be familiar with U.S. policy will know that foreign policy almost has no impact on who gets elected to be president. There's here and there, one of the things for instance, in the last election, the term was really the question of Iran and whether President Obama would go back into Iraq. And so that's okay. But it had no bearing on whether they were elected or not. They were domestic issues. We do go out quite a bit in order to ensure that there is understanding, and I'll come back to that later. But the brand issue, therefore, and why we call it a particular thing, was because we realized that our proposition in foreign policy is not necessarily coherent with a dominant paradigm in how foreign policy is carved. National interest is carved in very national, narrow nationalistic terms. So it has to deal with protecting the interests, the values, the way of life of a particular country and its people. And if you have to do that at the expense of others, so be it. Our national anthem is not only of God bless of Africa, it's because God is Africa. So unless the country as a whole decides that what we did in 1984 was a mistake, until then, our foreign policy has to represent that split. And this is what the paper tries to do, is to capture that. But it does put us on a slightly different paradigm then, and we've tried to grapple with it, and I think the Jay is correct that much more research and elaboration in an academic way needs to be done to extrapolate all these and put out there, because I think that there is discussion when you go into academics and others, the Jay mentioned some of these people who are in fact especially familiar with the term of Ubuntu and its history and how that manifests. And I think that's a really important discussion that we need to continue to have. I fully agree. It's important for us all to understand better what it is that we feel about this concept makes us as a country unique. But that's not how I alluded to. There's a recognition that South Africa is different. Many people who might not know much about foreign policy know that South Africa is different for some reason. And that difference is what gives us the real influence. That difference is what gives us the ability to mobilize people and to get people. Unfortunately, sometimes also to have the expectations of us that we can change the world, that we can do things which we may not necessarily always have the power and influence to change, but we have to ask to do so, or at least try sometimes to do. Now, within that context, the issue was raised that with policy making and so on, do we then neglect the North? On the contrary, it is important, vitally important, that we deal with whoever we can and need to deal to promote the sustainable development of our country. Our partners in the North are critically important in that exercise. There is no way South Africa can only turn to China, for instance, and say, well, China is our next best friend, they are our only friend. In international relations, in today's world, that is just not an option. Although, for instance, an agreement we have with the United States and the renewal of that is critically important. So our diplomats are hard at work trying to find ways to resolve this issue, because within the United States Congress, there are many concerns as to why South Africa, for instance, should not be part of AGOA, even if AGOA is renewed. Chances are AGOA is renewed, be renewed for Africa, but then South Africa will be considered a different place to the other African countries. Now, as we know, some African countries are already excluded, but that's because of the politics, for instance, Zimbabwe or Sudan. South Africa was excluded because it is seen as having graduated. We are too developed for this unilateral gesture from the United States to African countries to have duty-free, quota-free access to the markets. It will be devastating to South Africa's auto industry, our exports of fruit producers, wine, etc. Now, we have to negotiate with Congress and with the leaders in the U.S. Because the consequences would be extremely serious for South Africa. So I don't think we're under any delusion that the North and our partners in the North are not important, and we certainly can't afford to neglect them. But of course, I would say also to my colleagues in academia, if China is good enough for the U.S. and for Europe, why are you saying it shouldn't be good enough for us? China is the next big market. China is where the game has centered around now, and whether we like it or not, we have to engage. Now, we can be swamped by China by not engaging them, or we can get the respect that we get from them by engaging them. Yes, there will be debate as to when are we afternoon. We are back at the 30 now. As well, I think we're already allowing them to engage too much in our economy. I think these are important debates and we have to listen. We as a department go out and engage regularly. I engage in my house in some of these discussions with think tanks where we discuss BRICS, we discuss the rise of China, etc. And so our department is actively engaging those discussions and we do listen to the various research elements that come out because the academics will have the statistics, the brain trajectories, etc. And we get, I think, good use of the research material that they provide us in those debates and discussions. Economic diplomacy, I think it's an excellent question. This is something that, yes, commercial diplomacy, first of all, is different from economic diplomacy. Economic diplomacy, as a broader term, incorporates what the Honourable Members pointed out, how we influence international trade rules and regulations at WTO and other forums, G20 and so on, as well as promoting avenues such as tourism and other sectors. So it's not just about the commercial aspect of goods and services. We do recognize the importance of this. In fact, this is, as I said in my presentation, the sharp edge of our diplomacy. However, it can't be the only edge. I want to add that cautionary note because I think often it's forgotten that peace and security issues, for instance, on our continent are just as critical. Well, peace and security is not development. So when we talk to countries on the continent, we have to assist, for instance, in ensuring that there is a stable, peaceful situation in which we can then conduct trade and investment and so forth. But yes, it is to the extent that we have training within our branch of all our diplomats. All our ambassadors have been trained. We're now going with trained all the people in the mission that are particularly tasked with economic diplomacy. And all the diplomats, as they cycle in and out now, before they go out, part of their training is on economic diplomacy. A toolkit has been developed by our department, and all are trained with this toolkit. And we are also extending that to various areas of government. So the provinces, etc., we are also engaging in training, as well as with other government departments who are involved in trade issues. Yes, a lot of work in terms of training, as the Honourable Chairperson pointed out, is happening because we recognize how important it is that our diplomats are schooled in. I think it's going to be a long-term process because economic diplomacy itself is in such a flux at the moment with the post-2008 dynamics that are happening. And so economic diplomacy being the, if you wish, the one side of the coin to the political element which makes up the full picture, is going to go through those resolutions. And it's one thing to train our diplomats, it's another to know what the appropriate responses are to these rapidly changing dynamics. And that requires political direction, not just within our department, but I think at government level, at the national level, including as the chairman pointed out, from the various elements with in government as well. The African Renaissance and are we moving away from that? I don't think we've moved away. We are still, as I pointed out in my presentation and certainly in our annual report, it's quite clear that Africa remains a focus. We may not necessarily be speaking as much about the African Renaissance, but we've perhaps rightly or wrongly latched onto the changing language, the changing narrative. People talk of Africa rising, and now others are saying even that wording may be necessary to move on from that because it's a more complex process, not just a GDP growth that we need to factor in. Other things of elections, of social transformation, etc. And so the whole infrastructure. So we maybe need to move on to a different terminology and there's various debates as to what that is, rather than the purely investment-oriented concept categorizing, because that was what was made popular by those who were specifically looking at foreign direct investment and putting money in there, getting big profits and moving out. So we're not moving away from the African Renaissance in what it represents, but yes, the language of the engagement has changed. But by no means, Africa is not a lesser priority on the contrary, it is still central to our foreign policy. With regards to the relationship with BRICS and our alliances, I don't think, and I certainly would not want to believe that we are neglecting our other partners for the reasons that I stated. The US remains important, Europe remains important. We have critical negotiations that we need to conduct with our partners who are not in BRICS. But BRICS itself has, not just for South Africa, but globally, become a phenomenon that needs to be reckoned with and to be acted in. And it has become a game changer. And the fact that we are part of that, I think, is something that South Africa should be proud of, should cherish. But I take the point, and it's an important point, is how we engage it, what is it we want out of it, because I do agree, China has its plan for BRICS. I'm sure Russia has its plan for BRICS, and South Africa's plan for BRICS needs to continuously keep that in mind, so that we maximize the leverage we have out of it, that we maximize the privileged position we get out of being in this small club that is such a huge game changer in international relations. In terms of alliances, I think there's something that must be calibrated and nuanced a bit more in our discussion. I understand that in the media, these things are sometimes painted as mutually exclusive, etc. You talk to Russia and then there's the thing, Russia's not a best friend, how could you? I mean, one article I just read from a magazine that I got on the plane coming here, and which helped me to think about this presentation. But it was this scathing of our foreign policy, and it talked about that, I think, sort of becoming best friends with the devil, Putin, and so on. So it was written in this kind of emotive language that often in the media continues to then foster a perception that South Africa chooses friends in that way. I think it's important to understand that in these multilateral forums and some of these small groupings referred to in our take to the language as mini-laterals, because they're not huge global organizations, but they're 4, 5, 6 countries, or maybe 20 countries getting together. These mini-laterals are just as important in the multilateral system because they become stepping stones of countries that make decisions, and if they are key countries, they influence the direction at the greater global level, whether it's at the UN or at the EU level, and so on. So these bigger organizations benefit when smaller groups get together, make policy. Of course, they also then become more influential as little groupings. And BRICS, IFTA, G20, these are influential groups, and they're recognized to be such. Now, within them, South Africa finds itself sometimes having to negotiate before they become like-minded. Now, it's in the nature of multilateral diplomacy that countries who are not like-minded then start negotiating and having to make concessions until there's a consensus that is formed. And so it's not a case of making friends with one particular country because you have a friend with them and therefore you've gone to bed with the devil, as it is called. You negotiate, you deal with those with whom you don't agree. Diplomacy isn't about always hanging out with those with whom you agree. In fact, it is about dialogue with those with whom you don't agree. And so, yes, I understand why the media needs to cast it that way, but I hope the honorable members will engage us more. So I think have a nuanced approach, understanding what are the elements for those countries where we agree and where we don't agree, so that we see what the complexities of the negotiations are in order to further our agenda by bringing them on board, by getting them to see our point of view and influencing them with a smaller group, and within that smaller group we are then able to have more leverage with their support at a more global level. And this is how we conduct our diplomacy. Going to diplomacy and how this can relate to UN reform. In a nutshell, if we say, I am because you are, what I want for myself is what I would want for you, then the issue of UN reform is then not a narrow nationalistic thing that says South Africa should be in the UN Security Council because it has a voice in the... Why does South Africa want to be in these things? South Africa wants to be in because it is imperative for us that our continent voice is better, because then we will prosper too. If our continent is better off, we will be better off. And so, again, through the guidance of Ubuntu, the issue of global reform, of the trade regimes, the reform of the United Nations, not just in the UN Security Council conferences, because I should point out we often, again, talk about UN reform and meaning UN Security Council reform. Actually, the UN structure itself has gone through various phases of reform. Secretary Kofi Annan, before he tried to do reform, and Russia was a key partner in trying to help streamline it, bring it, because it's an international bureaucracy, like a department and it's needed to work on smaller budget, etc., etc. And so a lot of reform there was needed as well. Then the question on the green paper and the white paper and so forth. I acknowledge after the green paper we were sort of stuck between the world coming in wanting to establish embassies, South Africa having to establish embassies, and I think we've gone on with the job of conducting international relations at a far and furious pace, growing rapidly in terms of our number of personnel, integrating various sections of our national community who before had fought each other into one coherent department, trying to develop the policies for the department, not foreign policy, but department personnel policies, etc., that had to deal with the difficult task of establishing a unified department that functions well, that is paying well enough for the huge task at hand. I mean, we have faced the fact that some of our founders are one day within government, they used to leave behind the South African flag, and you were supposed to negotiate with people who, when you refer to things that previous international agreements, etc., who were late. We were the new kid on the block, and we had to stand our ground, and I hope I can say, certainly from where I sit, with confidence that South Africa was up to the task. But that meant that we didn't necessarily do all the in-house things that one would do. You were out there doing what was necessary. And so, yes, the issues of the green paper were looked at given that big time frame. And we have incorporated, as I said in my presentation, the principles. What was different in the green paper to the white paper was that at the time when we allowed the green paper, we had come out of the Cold War, the Berlin Wall was broken down, etc. And so here we found ourselves talking about the New World Order. And so by the time we wrote the white paper, that New World Order that we were speculating about was there. We were living in it. And so we had to change a lot of that language of the world in which we were operating. In 1996, we also had to speculate how South Africa positioned itself and so on. But in the late 2000s, of course, we had the benefit of hindsight, and so we didn't have to speculate about those things. So a lot of that language in the green paper had to be updated in that sense. But what we did not change was the fact that the values in our constitution had informed our foreign policy. The values that, as we put it in the paper, born out of struggle. The principles of our foreign policy, those remained the same, and we kept those. And of course, there were subsequent positions from the ruling party, etc., that informed these also because they reaffirmed those principles and those values through time. So as a benefit of hindsight, which I think strengthens the paper. But that's also why you cannot have a paper continuously stays in abeyance, because if it's not adopted, then you will continue to have to update language and never really adopt those firm principles. I'm trying to see a paper if I've read everybody, because I don't want to ignore anybody else. SECWA and TIFA, I think that's an important. The two counters, the two forums, the South African Council on International Relations is the one. Then the one on consultative forum on international, CIFA is the acronym we use. Now, what is the two different roles? The CIFA basically is within government, so we look at different spheres of government. So the cities, the provinces, etc., have international relations officials. They come twice a year at least. Our director general is the chairperson of that. And basically it is to give them feedback on key elements of our foreign policy, what are the key things we're doing, we're sharing that, we are going to host that, etc., etc. So it's shared in information. But more importantly, it is always nice because what has been happening is the mayor of a particular town wants to go to the United States, a small town somewhere in Utah, and wants to sign the citizens of the agreement. So there's all these things that have been signed, and at some point, government has to say, can we have some kind of order here? What are these things going to do, or are they just so that there's a piece of paper? How do we coordinate these visits? How do we coordinate the agreement between education departments of our country and that of other countries? Some governments were starting to say to us privately, for instance, you have people coming here, Mandali groups, etc., doing the same thing, but last month we had another delegation from your country, and a month before that, another delegation. So this is a coordinating forum where governments really looked at these visits, etc. In fact, I can say to the honorable members that we have been working on a database also that will allow us even better coordinators because we will actually have those visits logged and the outcomes, etc., so that they can be spread out more in terms of outcomes and information shared. And so this database should be in its final stages now, and then our Director General will have to approve that and then probably disseminate information on how it works. Now, on the other hand, the South African Council on International Relations is something akin to the U.S.'s also Council on Foreign Relations, which is really civil society. So these are not people in different spheres of government. These are people from business, from academia, and other non-state actors who are members of this, and they basically play an advisory role. This is a consultative forum where they meet twice a year with the minister. In between, our unit, in fact, will be supporting them as a sort of back office. They will use research data, etc., to say to the minister, this is how you dealt with this issue, this is how we feel about it, and so on, and engage the minister on issues of concern to them from their various sectoral perspectives. So that's more civil society oriented forum. It is not conflicting in terms of mandates, etc., because we don't have a standing body. What we do now at the moment is we meet in an ad hoc way. I will convene academics and say what you think of something and so on. I'll try and conclude. Is there anything so that I have left out? I've written with The reform of the Bretton Woods institution is critical, and this has to do with the unfair way in which trade relations are conducted, in which these institutions engage. And here we see, for instance, at the moment with the downgrading, etc., of South Africa's credit. The important fact is that if South Africa and many African countries are in a much worse state than South Africa in terms of having borrowed, say, from the IMF, so the creditworthiness of the country and what is borrowed through the IMF and so on can have a devastating impact on how long the country is essentially indebted and to what extent it is indebted, rather than spending its money on infrastructure, on social development. Now it has to pay off debt, and that still has to do with how much interest, and that interest is not determined by the country, but by the rating agencies and by the investment institutions. So the reform is important, and the question was, do we have formulas for this? Yes. For instance, in the Security Council, the Iwini consensus said Africa must have so many permanent seats and so many non-permanent seats. So yes, those have been established for the U.S. Security Council through the what we call the Iwini consensus. Mm-hmm. Similarly, we have for the World Bank how it should be structured in terms of the representation of African countries and developing countries in general. There's a formula that has been worked out too. And these are being pursued, as you may also be aware, in fact, even with the way the chair is rotated, South Africa tries to support that it doesn't go again to the range as it did. But of course, in the end, the rest of the developed world didn't stand together strongly enough to change that. But the fact that it's quite as far as it shows that there is a great appetite for countries now to stand up and say, if we don't put in our interest collectively, then we are going to change the way these things run. But for the institutions also meant that they have to take note of the groundswell of opposition, and so they are trying to make a greater effort to reform themselves before they are reformed, so to speak, by the sentiment of the international community. I'm be conscious of our time. And I would say, just in terms of outreach and the issue of perceived arrogance in the department, or the fact that the foreign policy is elitist. As I said earlier, foreign policy in many countries is not necessarily something that is as popularly understood. Be that as it may, we do believe that it's important because we put such a strong emphasis on the fact that our foreign policy has to represent our domestic imperative. Let me say, the honourable members would be aware that our ministers have to do 10 public participatory outreach programs every year. So we have 2 deputy ministers and 1 minister, so that makes 30. So yes, 30 that they have to receive. And so we have to ensure that they do that. So for instance, our minister will speak at UCD, our minister has spoken at UNISA, our minister has spoken first, etc. So there's so many of those that we facilitate, including my unit and public school. Sorry? Yes, yes. So they have to, and they do this. So we ensure that they do on their diary. So that's already 30 different at a ministerial level. I speak at universities, think tanks, the colleagues that we're here, John Lee's with ICD, AIDA has an annual Africa conference, and so on. So even in our performance, I engage constantly with them, speaking either as a panelist or as a chairperson of a roundtable discussion, etc. So there is quite a lot of activity. Do we reach every rural area? No. Do we reach every province? No. Do we reach the portfolio committee? I don't think so. Certainly, in past years, I have had much more contact with that committee on a regular basis, either through the things that we do in the department by inviting the committee to participate as well, or sometimes come here more often to engage on particular issues, not necessarily in the broad things that we're doing today, but let's say to discuss the U.S. relation and AGOA, or to discuss China and BRICS, etc. So I know that some of my other colleagues do come here for those reasons. But yes, we could certainly, from the foreign policy point of view, engage more. But there is a lot going on. Of course, to the extent that the media plays an informative role, I cannot determine for them, but often it's more a criticism which doesn't really unpack the issues in a balanced and nuanced way that informs people. And so when I read the kind of language that I alluded to in the article that I picked up in the airplane, it becomes a bit difficult to see how the public is informed in that way, not really being told that it's a bit more complex than that. But yes, we will keep on doing so. We've got Ubuntu Radio, which our department runs. Public diplomacy is very active. Our ministers are very active. Ubuntu magazine, if you fly on today, you'll see at the airport and so on. It's our magazine. And then, of course, our policy unit, as well as our other business units, regularly go out and do that. Jefferson, I think I'll leave it there. If I've left out anything, maybe the DGC has picked up.
Honorable Chair Member, thank you once more, and I hope it is good. We thank you very much for this opportunity. I just wanted to comment on one or two things. I was picking up only comments, and I left questions for my colleague here. Just to refer to its humility to the Honorable Committee that we this white paper process has been ongoing for some time. We did present to the select committee in March, on March the 12th, and our understanding was that it is very imperative to have this as a rough statement of our policy, which will assist us in grounding our envisaged legislation that has also been not able to move until recently because we could not take the donkey before the cat. It was that kind of a thing that while we want to legislate a mandate into that envisaged bill, however...
Don't be careful with the example you're making. Yeah. There are people who have never seen a donkey in their life. They have also never seen a cat, so they don't understand what I'm
Okay. Thank you, Chair. So we are really hoping that the collective wisdom committee in proposing amendments and for some of the, we took note of some of the things, for example, when the chair mentioned the to detail more on this thing of Ubuntu, etc., which is a very reasonable thing. We simply say Ubuntu and pass on, assuming that everybody understands what it is, etc. If that is the case, then Chair and Honorable Chair and Honorable Member, we believe that maybe we will reach a point where this this white paper would reach a conclusion and a finality, and then it would be, as we said, it's a broad statement which will not include full details of the national interest, which we believe there is a separate process about it. It sits with Cabinet as we speak now. But when the national interest is being elaborated on to mean certain things for a particular purpose, it will not be actually talking about the white paper itself as it is here. So our view, our considered view, Chair, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members, is that time permitting, if the committee is able to help us actually, because we realize that if the committee, as a successor in law of the previous committee, hasn't had an opportunity maybe to fully engage on this sufficiently to enable us to get more input and more directions, etc. As the process unfolds for us to submit the process of the legislation that we are currently assist with, the one will be informed by the rich input from the broad segment itself, because that one will take care of the nitty-gritties of the administration and other small matters, for example, whether we should include the Council on Consultative Processes acquire and the CPR in the law, the academy to keep it in there, etc. But what will be the crux of our approach if it is not based on at least a broad policy statement such as the foreign policy white paper, etc. So our request and our view and precisely the message, maybe the official request that we are bringing up to the Honorable Committee is to help us through this process, taking into consideration the views and other recommendations and proposals and, you know, directions, that once this process is done, then as we start the process that you will be engaged with, obviously in the new year, we believe, because we have just restarted the process of a long talk about the foreign service bill, which will really have to ensure that this committee has the principal authority on it as when it moves over. At least there will be a sequence and logical understanding between what the department has tried to put up as a broad statement and what it will want to put in the legislation. Basically, Honorable Chair and Members, this is where we are, and we are really thankful that we have reconnected with what we thought has been long in the pipeline. As you might have been aware that after the Cabinet approval in 2012, immediately in January 2013, we proceeded to submit, although there were some technical problems, issues about how it was brought about, until recently when we were helped by the same committee to understand how we should do it, and when we were invited to come and present it. Wow, that moment has come. Everything that we have put on hold will then come after the committee shall have applied its mind on this whole process. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Kalyan.
Thank you.
By one, we must be done.
Yes, I also have another meeting, so I will have to excuse myself shortly. Yes, just listening to the acting GG's comments, my understanding in terms of the rules of Parliament is that everything relapses at the end of a particular Parliament and has to be reintroduced. So we're not yet at that stage. Mm-hmm. Secondly, from last week's discussion, I understood, and I'm open to correction, that the Chapter 7 of the NDP was going to be revised and in the context of this white paper, but it hasn't been put in here, nor have we heard any comment on that. So I would say that your presentation is incomplete because we don't know what the revised chapter 7 looks like and the context in which it has been revised. I thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Honorable Alien. What I would say must happen, and in fact it should happen, is that we must have a second bite on whether we're discussing a white paper or we're just discussing South Africa's foreign policy. And the political principles should be there. Could be good on that day if we have deputy minister, because deputy minister Landers is appointed by the MEP to take care of the committee and to attend parliament, all like that. But the first deputy minister, Noma Inyam Pleto, is also assigned to specifically to certain parties. Now, when you have her here, you've got the two of them, then we engage on things that are political, for instance, issues about a deeper conceptualization and articulation of diplomacy of Ubuntu. I know, and I heard the minister articulating this one very, very well. But now, for members of the committee, you need an engagement of the concept is that South Africa punches above its weight. Deputy Minister Lenders once said, you know, I hate this expression, this patient. What does a South African say when you say your country punches above its weight? What should be the weight of your country? And what is the weight of the other country? Is the influence of a country influenced by numbers or by the principle that it stands for in world affairs? There are principles that South Africa has always been standing for and articulating, for which it is highly respected. Doesn't matter how big you are, whether you're in the United States or whatever, they know when it comes to this South Africa, that you stop in this one. This is what we're saying. So perhaps people don't know. Just use this kind of expression. And these other members have spoken about the issue about the foreign service bill that is still coming faster. We can have some discussion around that. Our membership of BRICS, are we extracting enough? We can fix one of the other good things that are coming in, the UN, the changing, all of those things. It could be good to have discussions and some of the deputy ministers are there. And the correction on the issues, which was done so well, by the way, Mr. Nasoro Dean. Yeah, you've done very well on the issue of the African license. Because in the public domain sometimes, particularly some in the academia, do say that we have jettisoned the African migrant vision or concept. They don't acknowledge or know that it is actually inbuilt into NEPAD, and that it is inbuilt into Agenda 2063. If you look at all the facets that Agenda 2063 serves. In 2013, this is South Africa, in the Africa that we have from 1963. And this is what the Africa was from now on up to 2063. I mean, from 1963 to 2013, and from 2013 to 2063. All of the things that must happen, these seven aspirations, all the wide-ranging factors today are actually taking us into the Africa we want. And it's an expression of the reawakening of Africa, the rebirth of Africa. Peace leader is back at time. I call it a regeneration. So remind them of regeneration and not different context. Is that the president today maybe should have indicated that he brought a lot of wisdom from the speech itself. The speech written by Pixlega Isaac Afem was presented in 1906 in the Columbia University when he was talking about the regeneration of Africa and how the turn of the 20th century will deal with the issue of Kalamba. There is an author who has also attempted to bring out some of the good issues about Pixlega Isaac Afem, this Dr. Moss Mashamaide, called the Second Coming. He speaks about the contribution of Pixlega Isaac Afem. But there are others, Kwame Nkrumah herself. The fact that 1967, when they became independent, this is the beginning of one day having a United States of Africa, which is your Agenda 2063, where Africa and the West together. That's Kwame Nkrumah, so many years ago. The first president of the
world.
So, Kwame Nkrumah, Nnamdi Azikiwe, Dr. Namza, of Nigeria, Tomo Kenyatta, Leopold Senghor, Julius Nyerere, Kenneth Kaunda. There are many others. And others that beyond Africa, you know, your Marcus Garvey, your W.E.P., the Boa, the whole thing about Pan-Africanism was actually beyond Africa. So when we have this engagement with the minister, we must look at all of them. Now, all of them, there's something I want to say about our work in Parliament now. When we are fully, and I'm saying this with respect now, we are fully educated in quotes about foreign relations and all the facets. Say 2015, I suggest that we must, as a committee, come with a lot of statements. I don't know whether it's with emotions without notice, but all of this that our country is doing in the world. We bring this to Parliament. Once a week or once a month or twice a month, a statement on what we are doing in this country, a statement on what we are doing in the DRC, the Inga Dam, the importance of the statement about what we think about what is happening in the Ukraine, a statement about Palestine, a statement on Cuba, a statement on certain personalities, especially on our earlier, about individuals that have passed on but have made a worthy contribution to humanity. As part of foreign affairs, we are going to talk about particularly those who won Nobel Peace Laureates, things like that. So we can actually quantify a number of things in Parliament. So that Parliament, because when we speak in Parliament, then it goes into the public domain. So I think those are some of the things we must do. Opinion pieces, for instance, we must release opinion pieces at the committee on an issue. And then the last one would be visits to provinces as a community. Engagement with people in a certain province, school meeting, foreign relations, etc., etc. So those are, I think, if we embark on that next year, this 7 or 8 or 9 months, at least we are better than May this year. We can now present some of these issues much more forcefully, much more in a better way. And then with that, therefore, my recommendation then says, we are going to have a meeting, I wonder if it will be this year. I'm not sure if time will permit for us to have a panel engagement with the minister,
and then we can get into all of the things that arose here. And from there, if it happens just after the state of the nation at times, it's fine. But I think I would love to see members of this committee just coming in different angles as a parliament. Because that's in foreign relations, the committee, international relations and cooperation is here. But just feel it. Because only us can lead those discussions in a parliament, you know? So, with that, thank you very much for the presentation. We are much, much more clarified now about the white paper on foreign policy. I hope we'll have some time still about discussions about the foreign policy field. Of course, every item, I'm not saying bring it now. Once it is undergone all the other processes, will come to us, the first power will also come to us, and then we'll then walk those into parliament and lead discussions there. With that, thank you very much. All our members, the meeting is an end official. The meeting is now adjourned. Unfortunately, I was told that if a meeting does not go beyond 1 o'clock, lunch is not served. You eat from your own pocket. Now, we don't know how deep our pockets are. Thank you very much. Yeah, well. Thank you.